Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Here you are.
So let's continue talking about starting there. So remember last time, this is the one we ended up with, where I graphed it out, and that shows us there's an interaction. One of the interesting things that this graph shows is that, while graphing helps, clearly there's an interaction. I mean, if the lines are crossing, the effect of one variable changes depending upon the level of the other variable. That's pretty obvious, right? I mean, first of all, B1's way bigger than B2 and A1, and then, in fact, they're almost equal at A2, but in fact, the order's switched. I should tell you something. It's hard to see where there are effects, though. Like, you know, is A bigger than B? Or sorry, A1 bigger than A2? Is B1 bigger than B2? It's a tough call. Interactions are a lot easier to see, typically, than main effects. Especially when you have these kind of interactions where they cross, which have a special name that I will mention shortly. All right. So if we're going to interpret interactions, it's a matter of, as far as the interpretation part goes, this is, you know, what does this mean? So when you look at your data, what does it mean? You got to be careful talking about main effects in the presence of interaction. Right? Because by definition, when you're talking about interaction, you're saying that the effect of one variable changes depending upon the level of a second variable. Is it possible then to talk about a main effect without mentioning the interaction? Because when you talk about main effects, statistically they're there. That's not the issue. It's a question of, is it something you can interpret? With an ordinal interaction, that's one where the order of the main effects is preserved. So that would look like, say, this. Those aren't parallel. There's an interaction there. You can see that the effect here is smaller than it is here. But the order of the main effects is preserved, right? So if this is A1, B2, B1, B2, the order of the main effects is preserved. B2 is bigger than B1. But that difference is a little smaller here at A2 than it is at A1. I'd be pretty comfortable personally interpreting that main effect. Because while the effect is smaller at A2 between B2 and B1, it's not like it's something that makes me say, oh, I can't talk about this without mentioning the other variable. Right? I can. I'm perfectly happy doing that. I don't have a problem with it. So it's pretty easy to do, and that's what's called an ordinal interaction. That's when the order of main effects is preserved. When we have a disordinal interaction, it's really almost impossible to interpret main effects. I mean, you could draw something like this. A1 is bigger than A2 at B1. That's all I can say. I can't say. It's probably the case, in fact, that B1, on average, look, is bigger than B2. Yeah. But do you feel comfortable talking about that? Can you do it without mentioning the other variable? And it becomes very difficult. So typically, one would say, I'm not going to do that. I will report the effect in a paper I'm writing, but I won't interpret it. What I'm going to interpret is the interaction. Right? So if you think about a sort of classic memory example, the Tolving-Shacker and Stark example I gave you the other day, where we have three retention intervals, which is 1 hour, it's 24 hours, in 7 days. And we have an explicit memory test, which is actually not experiment, it was recognition. So it's there, there, there. Looks like that, just like you would expect. And they have an implicit test, which was word fragment completion. And it's there. So this is the implicit test. And this is the explicit. Spelled explicit. Okay. Now, in that case, because on average, if you sort of collapsed across memory test type, there's a main effect of retention of them. Right?
There is.
Would you interpret it?
Well, no.
Because you wouldn't say, well, statistically there would be. You would say, yeah, I have a significant effect of retention interval, but I don't care. Because retention interval only affects explicit tests, not implicit tests. I can't talk about retention interval without mentioning the test type. Right? So in that case, you don't interpret it the main effect at all. It would be silly to. Right? You will hear people say you never interpret an interaction in the presence, a main effect in the presence of interactions. I think that's a little strong. It's a defensible position, but I think it's a little strong, because if we've got something like this, I'm pretty comfortable talking about that thing. I'm pretty happy with that. I wouldn't do it here. That's ridiculous. I wouldn't do it in this way either. Right? Though I might say that B1's bigger than B2. I might be happy with that. Yeah. But I wouldn't talk about the main effect of A. It's probably there. Because I can't talk about it without mentioning. Right? And I probably still wouldn't end up talking about the main effect of B. You know, unless there's a really good theoretical reason to. So you got to sort of always realize that there's two things. There's statistical significance and there's practical significance. Statistically, something can be significant. That's not an issue. That happens all the time. 0.05, great. But does it mean anything? Right? It's like if you test enough people, you will find differences all the time. Right? You know, you'll find correlations that are significant, for example. Between... think something completely inane. There's a correlation, I guarantee you, between the size of your big toe and the number of children you have. Possibly. You know why? Because adults have bigger toes than children. Children don't have kids. Is that, and it would be significant too. Does it matter? Probably not. Right? So it's a matter of, do we interpret that or not? And that's the case with some of these things. They're statistically, there is, if you go back and read Cullen chapter and start, statistically there is a significant effect of retention. They don't talk about it because it's stupid to. You can't. Because you can't talk about one without mentioning the other, without one variable without mentioning the other. And that, to me, is the test. That's what I do. If I'm writing something up, I read it. I look at the graph and I say, can I talk about one variable without mentioning the other? If I can, I'll go ahead. If I can't, I just don't. I don't talk about it. I report it, but I don't interpret it in the discussion section. Right? So it's a matter of, can I, in good faith, talk about an effect of a variable without mentioning any other variable? If I can't, then I'll talk about it. Then I'll do that. Make sense? All right. So, remember how we partitioned the degrees of freedom and sums of squares for the regular analysis of variance, with sort of one way, the vanilla one, I guess you would want to call it. Well, let's do it with this for the two-way analysis of variance. Factorial. Okay, so remember our model, which is x equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon. Right? And that's going to tell us what our sums of squares are going to be. We're going to get a sum of squares for A, we're going to get one for B, we're going to get a sum of squares of AB, and we're going to get a sum of squares error. And those should all add up to a sum of squares total. Okay? Okay. Questions so far? So sum of squares total equals sum of squares A plus sum of squares B plus sum of squares AB plus sum of squares error. And then those will have degrees of freedom to go with them and partition them along with the sums of squares. Okay. Questions? Makes sense. It's the same thing we did before with one way in open. Yeah, please.
In the factorial number equation, is
yeah.
it possible to just switch mu with x sub g, meaning grand mu?
Yeah. I mean, like, what you mean in the model?
Yeah.
No.
Why?
Because those are parameters. They're not statistics. Using x bar sub g, that an x bar is a statistic, not a parameter. That's a parameter. The model is parametric. It's about populations.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics, which is how we actually end up doing this, different matter. But that's in essence what you're doing. What you're saying technically is incorrect. You can't do it. But practically, you're right. Practically, you're right. Because in fact, when we start to break this thing down into these great big sum of this, sum of this, in fact, we talk about grand mean, we'll talk about x bar sub g. But so practically you're right, but theoretically you can't in the model itself, because the model is about parameters. It's not about statistics. But the parameters, the way the parameters in the, I don't want to use the word interact, the way the parameters work together in the model, that's what tells us how the stats are going to work. Yeah, it's a good question. A very deep question, actually. All right. Other questions? Okay. So think of it this way. We got sum of squares for A. That's just the same n as sum of squares for B. Those are just going to be square deviations of column means from the grand mean. So columns and rows. It's the same thing we did before with the deviations of group means from the grand mean. But now it's going to be columns, so we're going to put A in columns, which I tend to do, I think, and B in rows. Right? So if I was to sort of draw this, diagram this out, and there's groups in here. So if we're getting the sums of squares for A, we're going to get this, the column mean. Right? So it's going to be the x bar for this column, and then the x bar for this column. And then we're going to see those deviations from the grand mean. For B, it's going to be square deviations of the row means from the grand mean. So we're going to get these row means from the grand mean. So we're ignoring, if we're getting the column means, B's. We're ignoring the levels of A if we get the row means. Right? We sum across them, divide by, in this case, 2. Just like we did when we were breaking down the tables the other day. Right? And that was what we were doing. Remember that? We'd add them up and divide by the number of observations, which, because I was making them simple, was always 2. Questions? Now, so keep thinking about this. This is the harder one, sum of squares AB. These are square deviations of cell means. That's the cell means, the individual values in here. The cell means, the averages for there. Because remember, when we did that, I said those were cell means. Those are averages of scores that people got. So the square deviations of the cell means from what we would expect given the row and column means. So put the row and column means in. And do we get anything different from that? Because that's what an interaction is. Is it different from what gives the effect, the contribution of A and the contribution of B? In other words, again, thinking back, when we broke those things down, we're going to get what's left over. We take out the row, we take out the column, we take out the grand mean, right? What's left is the interaction. Those are deviations. In that case, they're deviations from 0 because we took out the grand mean. So in fact, if you squared those numbers and summed them, you'd get the sums of squares for interaction. So if it's like, you know, plus 2, minus 2, minus 2, plus 2. Okay? The sums of squares for interaction would be 16. 4, 4, 4, 4. If the column means were plus 5, minus 5, the sum of squares for A is 50. 25 and 25, 5 squared twice. If it's plus 7 and minus 7, the sum of squares for B is going to be 98. 49 and 49, 7 squared and 7 squared. See, there was a reason I was having you do all that stuff with breaking down the tables and showing you to take out this and take out that, because that's actually how it works. You took out the grand mean to just purely have the mean effect there. So they're just deviations from zero instead of deviations from the grand mean. Questions? Sum of squares error, that's really the easiest one. All those are square deviations of individual scores from their cell means. The scores, the average for A1, B1, whatever the hell it is, let's say it's 9, and there's 5 people in that group, well, you know, so there's numbers like 8, 12, 9, 11, and 10. Yeah, that average to 9. No, one of those should have been 7. Anyway, we take those deviations from their cell mean. We square them. Do that for that cell. Then we do it for this cell. And we add all those up, then we do it for this cell. And all those up, and do it for this cell. And we get the sum of squares for error. We didn't do that when we were doing breakout tables because it's a pain. But the principle is exactly the same.
What's
the
cell mean again?
What's the cell mean? It's just like what the average is for A1, B1. What's the average score in A1, B1? What's the average score in A2, B1? Right? So, I almost hurt myself there. So, if like this is 5 in here, A1, B1, that's the cell mean. Okay. So, then you do the deviations of individual scores, the individual subject scores, from that cell mean.
And then do you combine all 4 cells?
Yeah, you add them all up, add the deviations up. Yes. Add the square deviations up. Did that answer your question? Or?
No.
Okay.
That's okay. I think I got my own answer.
You think you're okay? Okay. Is this making sense?
I think you're
okay. See, we didn't have that in there because those would have taken forever to do those examples. Because then I'd have to do all the... It's just a pain. But if we had 5 scores and our average was 9, right? So we have a score of, say, 9 and 10 and 8 and 7 and 11. We take all those scores and how much they deviate. The sum of scores for error for contribution from the one cell in that case would be 10 because we get 2 and minus 2 and 1 and minus 1 and 0. Square all those things, add them up. In that case, it's 10. They're just deviations of individual scores from cell means. The same way we had deviations of individual scores from group means for sum of squares error, and we added them up to the next group for one-way analysis of error. It's exactly the same principle. It's literally exactly the same principle. And I'm using literally properly there. Not the way so many people use it, but maybe figuratively. Which drives me crazy. No, this is literally apples and oranges. No, it isn't. Literally apples and oranges is literally apples and oranges. I see no fruit here at all. It drives me nuts when people do that. It's really simple. English is a subtle, wonderful language, and it's really easy to make mistakes, but it's also easy to speak properly if you have a vocabulary and know the grammar. But irregardless, so... That's just lazy. It's actually a word, but it's lazy speaking. Okay. Now I'm going to show you the math. Don't get worried. Okay. No, all this is what I was just saying. Take left. That's for sum of squares total. It's individual scores minus the grand mean squared.
There you go, man.
Great. These are being weighted by the number of groups, number of levels. So if that's A, it would be 2, and B, that would be 2. And it's the number of subjects per group. Okay? Don't worry about the weighting so much right now. Take a look at what's inside the brackets. Okay. X bar sub J, that's going to be the column means. And then there's a dot there, and that means I summed across, I ignored the B's. That's all that means. Just notation. Minus the grand mean square. Column means, whatever, column means, minus the grand mean square. Just what I said. This is all that this stuff is a way to write stuff out and not have to say this in all these words. This is the interaction. This is each score. Okay? And we subtract the cell mean. We subtract... Sorry. Screwed that... Yeah. We subtract the, this is the individual score, subtract the row mean, the column mean, and add the grand mean back in. You're like, what? Why are you adding the grand mean back in? Because if you take out the row mean and the column mean, right? The row mean and the column means together make up the grand mean, don't they? So if you take it out twice, what you've done there is you've actually removed the grand mean twice, you've got to put it back in once to balance everything back out. All that is taking the cell means and subtracting what you'd expect. And then finally, this is the one that you can't see.
There we go.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, sorry, this is the sum of squares for error. Individual score minus the row mean minus the column mean plus the grand mean. This is the cell mean minus the grand mean squared. Why is this summed a whole bunch of times? Because you got to do it once here, once here, once here, once here. Every time you do this, you got to sum. This isn't something to worry about. The point of this is, it's exactly what we did when we took stuff out. Remember we were taking things out and then getting numbers? That's just mathematically saying, remove the grand mean, and what score do you have? Remove... For A, what scores do you have for B? What deviation? What do you have left over? That's all that is. So, the whole thing has big N minus 1 degrees of freedom. Big N's the number of observations. That shouldn't surprise you. How many values have you fixed here? Remember, we're doing degrees of freedom. How many values have you fixed? To do this, just one. And you're going to say, wait a second, you calculated that. And you said, no, the numbers don't know where they came from. You're fixing one mean. You have, how many levels of A do you have? Let's say we have A levels of A. So we lose A minus 1 degrees of freedom. This is just like how we have K minus 1 degrees of freedom. Right? K minus 1 degrees of freedom. For number of groups, minus 1 is number of levels of A. So, coincidentally, for B, it'll be number of levels of B minus 1. Now, think about this. If we were breaking this down, I said to you, or instead of breaking it down, let's build it back up like we did in the quiz, right? Okay, what's the effect of B going to be? For B1, what is it? Give me a number.
6.
So it's going to be 6 for... What happens to B? That's got to be minus 6. It must be. They must sum to 0. Remember that?
Oh.
So you've lost 1 degree of freedom. You have 2 minus 1, which is 1. For the interaction, you have A minus 1 times B minus 1. How in the hell? What? Well, think about this. Take a look. So let's say we have a 2 by 2. So the interaction, let's go to 6 here. Oh, minus 6, plus 6. Okay, we have 1 degree of freedom. We would have to put 1 arbitrarily. Okay. Okay, let's put a 4 here. And I don't know, we can do something else. We can put a 2 here. Yeah. Uh-oh. 4 minus 4. That's going to be minus 2. Minus 2 plus... So that's going to be minus 2 again. And then that means that's going to be plus 2. I had 2 numbers for you. I put 2 values in arbitrarily. And 2 times 1 is 2. Let's make it bigger. Let's make it a 3x3. So let's just use 1s. Makes life a little easier. Put a 1 here. Let's put a 1 there. Put another 1 here. Put a 1 here. So that's so far 4. I've been able to just put up whatever I want. Oh, but that's got to be minus 2. It must be, right? Because that's got to sum to 0. Oh, now that's there. So that's got to be plus 1. Doesn't it? Has to be. Minus 2. That's got to be minus 2 here, which means that's got to be plus 1. That's got to be minus 2. Notice how it all sums to 0. Right? So I have 4 degrees of freedom there. 3 by 3, 2 minus, 3 minus 2 times 3 minus 2. Oh, sorry, 3 minus 1 times 3 minus 1. 2 times 2 is 4. If you have a 9 by 9, you have 64 degrees of freedom. I'm not going to do one of those. It'll take a long time. If you have an 11 by 11, you've got 100 degrees of freedom. Right? 11 minus 1 is 10. 11 minus 1 is 10. 10 times 10 is 100. All right. Questions?
Is it not just helpful to think of this like Sudoku, but everything has to equal 0?
If you like doing that stuff, I guess, yeah.
Dang, what do the P and the Q?
The P and the Q are the number of levels of A and levels of B.
So which one? Oh, right, A is the Q?
Yeah.
What do you mean by levels?
1, 2, 3. 3 levels. Levels of the variable. Completely carved. Like H of each.
I was just saying, like, high, medium, low, or...
High, medium, low, 0, 5, 7 drinks, if it's an alcohol experiment. Yeah, high, medium, low is great. Sure. Then the number of levels of the variable. Perfect. Yes, sir?
Is the A minus 1 and B minus 1, is that for the...
levels of A.
There?
Yep.
Or under?
That's the number of levels of A, levels of B.
Okay, so what's that one there?
This
is for the error?
That's, no, sorry, I screwed that up. That's actually, that's the interaction.
Okay.
For the error, this is wacky. How are we going to do this? Error is interesting because we're doing deviations from each cell mean. How many subjects are there in each cell?
One.
No, it's not one. You could do the experiment then. That's just watching stuff happen. That's not an experiment. Right? Single subject design, you know what that is? That's watching things happen and writing some of it down. It's not an experiment. I have a different view of that than some people, but that doesn't matter. I'm right, they're wrong. No. That may be true, but you know. Pick up your own minds. Okay, how many subjects in general, how many subjects are in each cell? Generally. It's not a number, it's a letter.
S. Or N.
N, little n. Little n. When we do the deviations from the mean in the cell, how many degrees of freedom have we lost in each cell? Like just within the cell?
One.
How many cells are there?
I guess it depends on how many.
Yeah, so generally what would you say?
K.
No, a K. Because K is for, there's K groups. How many, but how many groups are there?
So what is K equal if you want to call it?
J?
No, you can't just pick another letter. You can't just, yes, A times B. Well done.
Good job.
Right, because there's A times B groups. Poster strudels for breakfast. Those things, by the way, are horrible, and they're also nature's perfect food at the same time. They come with that little packet of horrible icing. You can never get it to come out looking like it does on the box, and you try. You know, this morning I said to Jonathan, what do you want for breakfast? He said, He does it. Sometimes, you know, little kids, they'll put their hand up, even at home. So he goes, I want toaster strudel. I said, perfect, I'll have one too. So I put them in the thing. And they come, I get the little packets of icing. And for once, I've actually got them separated such that I haven't just ripped the icing in half. So for once, that's happened. So then I carefully, and I go, I even have the little speck. It's going to work. And I'm doing this, and it's like, it's just not working. It's really annoying. But they are quite delicious. They're quite delicious. I know that, you know, on the plains of the savannah 200,000 years ago, had you gone up to some guy and said, you can either eat what it is you're out to hunt or have one of these. What do you think of that? He'd be like, and then humanity would have died out.
I have the problem of using way too many of the icings on the first one, so then I get stuck.
They have no icing left. Then you gotta make icing, and your kid's like, oh, there's no icing! Oh, yeah, I'm gonna make icing at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Jam on it.
Yeah, we'll put jam on it. Yeah, or just some syrup, you know, just to sweeten it up a bit. Yeah. You can use those actually as the two sides of a. I did this when I was a young person, like you guys. This was like one of my hangover foods. I would take two of those and I would toast them, and then I would put sausages in the middle and eat it like a sandwich.
Oh, dear.
It's amazing how the mind still. It really is amazing that I live to be, you know, pushing 50 at this point.
Yikes.
Okay, you know, whenever you do the expected value for like this back in the old days, we were talking about simple analysis variance, and the expected value for mean squared treatment was basically tau plus epsilon, and the expected value for mean squared error was epsilon. And then we knew to figure it out, well, it's pretty obvious in that case, if we're going to find out if there's a treatment effect, we're going to take mean squared treatment divided by mean squared error. Yep, so let's do that for this. Oh, why did I do that? I have it right there. Why did I just say that and write that down? It was written right here. So the expected value for simple ANOVA, mean squared treatment, is epsilon plus tau. And expected value for mean squared error is epsilon. So we would divide mean squared treatment and mean squared error to find out if we have an effect. Right? Yeah, so that's basically we're doing the same thing here. Except now we're going to have mean squared A, mean squared B, mean squared AB, and mean squared error.
Thank you.
Yep.
Do the two epsilons not just cancel if they're the same number?
Basically, yeah.
So what's the point of even adding them?
Well, no, because you got the top, right? Which basically says that it's tau over epsilon plus 1, right?
Why 1?
Because epsilon over epsilon cancels to 1.
Then why is it also tau over epsilon if epsilon
tau over epsilon. Like, it's like, if this was 3 plus 4 over 4, yeah, that's also 3 fourths plus 4 fourths. Just math.
Then why do we keep the E on the bottom?
Because it's we're dividing by.
But if they canceled out, then it wouldn't...
They don't cancel out here. They'll cancel to 1 on this one, just on this part.
Now you have to look at T plus E, or tau plus E, as being in brackets.
Yes. Yes. So we have the same thing here. We got mean squared A, mean squared B, mean squared AB, and of course mean squared error. Mean squared error is going to be exactly what you expect it to be. In fact, these are all going to be what you expect them to be, assuming you're expecting them to be anything whatsoever. But these are not going to be surprising. Expected value of mean squared A is alpha plus epsilon. Expected value of mean squared B is beta plus epsilon. The expected value of mean squared AB is alpha beta plus epsilon. The expected value of mean squared error is epsilon. Yay! So we're going to divide this by this, this by this, and this by this. So now we're going to do 3 F tests to determine if there's an effect of A, if there's an effect of B, and if there's an interaction. So that's wonderful. That's right. That makes sense. Sure. So you're dividing all of them by mean squared error to kind of. It's not really isolating, but to isolate the effect in essence, basically, to find out how much is there effective A, is there effective B, is there an AB effect. Great. Yay. And the crowd goes wild.
Yay.
However, you thought it could be a but, but what? Those expected values are only the case. They're only the case when you are only interested in those particular values of A, B, A, and B, and no other values at all. In other words, all you care about at all are the levels 1 and 2, or high, medium, low, or whatever, A, and the levels 1 and 2, whatever the hell they are, of B. You are not interested whatsoever in the levels, in anything between 1 and 2, between 2 and 3. The math only actually works if those are the only levels you're interested in. And you're going to say, what do you mean? How does that, how can the math know? Because of the theory behind this said, these are what you're interested in and nothing else. And I'll show you in a second, there's another way to look at this. And then you'll see, oh, I see why. That it's going to be different with something else. So, again, you're only interested in and think about the Tolman-Shacter and Stark experiment, right? We had 5 minutes, 1 hour, or four, sorry, 5 minutes, 24 hours, 7 days. That means if you draw that graph, which everybody always does, the line graph, technically you can't connect the dots. Because you don't know anything about what happened in 4 days. You can't interpret it that way. Whoa. That's bad. It's just dots. It's called a fixed effect model. That's the, it's the standard one we use, by the way. It's called a fixed effects model. Okay. What if we randomly chose the levels? Randomness is always our friend in statistics. Why don't we randomly choose the models? We'll put all the possible levels in a hat, and we'll draw them from a hat. Okay, so we can randomly choose models. Or levels, rather. So it comes out that it's 2 hours, 72 hours, and 42 seconds. That's the three levels we just randomly chose. Move from a hat. Okay, that's called a random effects model. Okay, and this is where things get weird. You're going to say, why the expected values of mean squares change? The way you calculate the mean squares doesn't change at all, but the expected values of mean squares change. And you're saying, why? Well, it's because we have to, the math behind this has to take into account the random choice of levels. Okay? Yep.
In your slides have the epsilon, and the slides I printed from you have...
They might have a sigma. Yeah, I probably didn't print out the better versions where I caught the mistake I made.
So
yeah.
Those supposed to be epsilon.
Those sigmas should be epsilons, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
They should be confusing.
Yeah, they should be epsilons. They should be epsilons, not sigmas. Okay. In this case, if we randomly choose the levels of A and B... The expected value of mean squared A is alpha plus alpha beta plus epsilon. For mean squared B, it's beta plus alpha beta plus epsilon. The interaction suddenly just shows up as part of the expected value. Mean squared A B is alpha beta plus epsilon. Okay, that didn't change. And that didn't change. So how are we going to find that if there's a main effect of A? What are we going to divide mean squared A by? No. Mean squared A, it's already divided by something minus 1, right? It's a mean squared or a sum of squares. What are we going to divide mean squared A by to find out if there's an effective A, to isolate alpha?
The number AB?
Yeah. Mean squared AB. Look. Okay. That's the only one left. Yeah. What are we going to divide mean squared B by? Well, same thing. Now, mean squared AB, happily, we still divide by the mean squared. But what we call our error term for the main effects now is the interaction. We divide mean squared A by mean squared AB. We divide mean squared B by mean squared AB. We divide mean squared AB by mean squared error. That's for a random effects model. When we randomly choose levels, we don't do that very often, actually.
In fact, I don't know that I've ever done this.
There's a reason I'm telling you about this, and it will come clear in about a week. Well, more than a week, because I will be here next week on Thursday. Yeah, I'll be in Florida. Yeah. A week from right now, I will still probably be asleep. Oh, yeah. Listen to the ocean. Going, waking up with a hangover, going, I've got to give a talk this afternoon. It's what you got to do. It's what you do. It's my job. So we get divided by B squared A by B squared B by B squared AB. That becomes our error term. Now, the error term for B squared AB is still B squared error. So it just changes. It's very rare when we do this in psychology, that we use a random effects model. Now, what if we did a mixed model where A is fixed and B is random? And this is going to look ass backwards, and it's not. I'm right. Okay, A is fixed, yet the expected value is alpha plus alpha beta plus epsilon. B is beta plus epsilon, even though B is the random, and then those two are the same. So in a random effects model, sorry, a mixed model where A is fixed, what do we divide mean squared A by? By the interaction. What do we divide mean squared B by? By mean squared error. What do we divide mean squared AB by? Mean squared. And I know that looks backwards, and it's not. Okay? It's counterintuitive, but it's... A is fixed, B is random. And like I said, I know it looks backwards. And I know it isn't. Don't you think those look backwards? So that looks like that's the expected value for mean squared A is A alpha plus alpha beta plus epsilon. That looks a whole hell of a lot. In fact, it's exactly the same as the one for a random effect, but I said A was fixed. So that's not a typo, and I know it's counterintuitive. The typo is that maybe if you downloaded the PDFs, that the sigmas are epsilons. They shouldn't be sigmas, they should be epsilons. I finally made that change. Every year I'd say, I gotta remember to make that change, and I wouldn't. And I did. And it was good. I still have to go to the internet, though. Okay. I know this is weird, but it's the way it is. Same. So, we're assuming you may think, why don't we always use random effects model then if we can talk about all the levels? Well, we're assuming the random effects model that we actually are randomly sampling levels, and that the levels of the randomly sampled, randomly sampled levels are independent of each other. We never meet that assumption. Hardly ever. It's very rare. So what we do is we do a fixed effect model analysis typically. So what we typically are actually doing, is a kind of sort of random fixed effect model. Kind of. But what the math we use, the expected values we use, are for a fixed effect model. We almost always use that. We don't use random effects, except under a very specific circumstance that I will tell you about later next week, or the week after. All right. The question you have to ask yourself is, did you do anything remotely like randomly selecting the levels?
Yeah.
and you never did. Not even remotely like it. You purposely got them. So, like, it's different than, like, you know, we always say that the subjects are randomly selected and we sort of nudge and a wink, they really work. But they were a lot more closely randomly selected than we actually purposely picked the people. Right? So, in that case, we go, yeah, we satisfied that assumption enough. We don't when we select our levels. Or exceedingly rarely do we. Okay. You get an analysis of variance summary table that looks like this. Source of variation, A, B, A by B, error, and total. Now, this might say, when you do like an analysis using SPSS or any other statistical program, you will get probably the name of the variable, and then you'll get name of the variable times name of the other variable. Right? And then you'll get something you'll say error or say residual, something to that effect. So you get A minus 1 degrees of freedom, B minus 1 degrees of freedom. The sums of squares are sum of squares A over A minus 1, sum of squares B over B minus 1. There's no division there, there should be. Sum of squares AB divided by A minus 1 times B minus 1. Sum of squares error divided by AB times N minus 1. And if you're doing fixed effects, mean squared A over mean squared error, mean squared B over mean squared error, mean squared AB over mean squared error.
So, once you've gotten all those, do you have to add them together somehow so you can define the F?
No. Those are three Fs. Those are three tests.
Oh, so you have to
is there an A effect? Is there a B effect? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Is there an A effect? Is there a B effect? Is there an action? You find out if they're significant. Right? Okay. So that's what you end up with in the end. You get the sum. It looks a lot like the other one, except it's got these two extra terms, one more variable, and the interaction term. All right, so one more variable and the interaction term, but still, it's the same principle. It's the same principle totally. These designs can get bigger than this. I just threw in a C in. Now I got C1 and C2, A1 and A2, and B1 and B2. So now I have six cells. Sorry, eight. I got two levels of A, two levels of B, and two levels of C. So now, with a design like this, and this is not an uncommon design. This would be a 2x2x2. This is not an uncommon design. Okay, this is... I've used this kind of design many times before, for example. So now what we have is you have three main effects, A, B, and C. You have three two-way interactions, A, B, A, C, and B, C. And you have a three-way interaction called A, B, C. This is where interpretation starts to get a little more complicated because it's hard to interpret these interactions in the presence of one of these. So a two-way in the presence of a three-way. What is a three-way interaction? It's just that the two-way interactions change depending upon the level of a third variable. What is a 49-way interaction? That's the 48-way interactions change depending upon the level of the 49th variable. So that's what a two-way interaction changes depending upon the level of some third variable. All right. And we will continue talking about interactions, main effects, fixed effects, random effects, various models, sums of squares, and expected values on Tuesday. Thanks, guys.
Here you are.
my cold, lonely soul sweet release from my weary past. Always searching one missing piece was you, and I beg you come away with me. And together we will find a place to call our own. I can't wait to see what I can do with a laptop like you. Not your CD slot or the Unix on which you are based. You make my lap hot. It's underneath your aluminum case there's love, and I forgive your strange one-button mouse. I forgive the way your keyboard leaves marks on your screen. I can overlook a fault or two for a laptop like you. We will always be together in love and spite. Tied through wind and weather, heaven knows what time may bring. In a year or two, you will seem big and heavy and slow. I will carry you to wherever it is laptops go to die. Don't think it won't be hard on me. How am I ever gonna find a way to justify the money I will spend on something new for a laptop like you?
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.